Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Connolly, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 8th. We have four cases on our calendar this morning. Yours is the first one for oral argument. We have two for oral argument. We'll leave after this and retire to our chambers for a Zoom argument. This case before us is A22-0083, Thomas M. Fafinski versus Jaron Johnson. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. You can either use the podium right next to you if you like, or you're welcome to use the center podium, which also goes up and down and has better viewing of the lights, the timing lights. So whatever you prefer. If for each of you, when you start your principal argument, if you'll just state your name and the party you represent for the record. And we're ready to go if you are.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Rose. I'm the attorney for the appellant Thomas M. Fafinski in this matter. The lower court's ruling in this case simply paraphrases the American rule and states its conclusion that there was no basis in Minnesota law to go beyond the American rule to award appellant's request for attorney's fees as increased costs in the enforcement of the judgment that he received against respondent in a separate matter. The American rule allows a party to shift the attorney's fees from themselves to their adversary under certain conditions. Those conditions being that the party's tortious conduct or breach of contract thrust or projected a party into litigation with a third party, that the third party litigation be a natural and proximate consequence of the misconduct, and that the third party litigation was done in good faith. That's precisely what's happened here, Your Honors. Here, respondent and his entity, Benepartum Law Group, fraudulently transferred Benepartum's Law Group's assets. That's the tortious conduct, Your Honors. He transferred them to a third party, his father, Douglas Johnson, putting those assets beyond appellant's reach. That conduct thrust appellant into litigation with respondent's father, Douglas Johnson, to avoid the transfer and enforce the judgment he obtained against respondent. A third-party litigation against Douglas Johnson was the natural and proximate consequence of the fraudulent transfer. In fact, there's a whole body of codified law that allows such an action to take place, historically called the Minnesota Uniform Fraudulent Transfers Act, known as MUFTA, now known as the Minnesota Avoidable Transactions Act. Obviously, this was done in good faith. It was successful. Although success isn't a requirement.
Here's the part that's different about your case that makes it unusual, I think. And as all of the cases, I mean, generally the exception, as I read the cases, the exception to the American rule about attorney's fees for this wrongful conduct exception looks at that as a measure of damages that one can get against the tortfeasor. You know, that person was either had to defend in an action or bring an action against a third party, and those damages become, the attorney's fees become damages against the tortfeasor, is sort of, I think, what the theory is underlying it. And then you prove up those damages in the claim against the wrongdoer, right? And in your case, and in every case that I think was in the briefs and that we found, the actual wrongdoer, tortfeasor, whatever, is the party in the action against whom the damages are being sought, either because there's a follow-on action or because they're all joined together, you know, all the defendant and a third party and a plaintiff in one action. Your case is unusual because there is a 2015 judgment against Jaron Johnson, and then there's a later lawsuit not involving him against Doug Johnson. Those attorney's fees, just through a motion to assess, I think, costs against a creditor under 549.09 was what your motion was. to reopen the other judgment from 2015, just add attorney's fees on, not as like a measure additional damages or what have you, where there would be an actual sort of, you know, that would be a contested matter. I mean, there's nothing like that, that in those cases. It's just an odd way to seek damages to actually bring this motion under 549.09 and try and invoke the rule there. You know what I'm saying?
I think I follow you, Your Honor. I would slightly disagree with your interpretation. Under the prior Lake versus Growth case, I think that those facts follow ours fairly in lockstep, with the exception that rather than going back to a prior lawsuit for the attorney's fees and expenses, the plaintiff in that case then sued the misdoer, the bad actor, in a subsequent action, asking for the expenses and the attorney's fees in that case.
Exactly. Sought the damages in a claim against the tortfeasor. Sought as damages those attorney's fees. Chronologically, it's out of order here. You got the judgment against the tortfeasor, and now later you want to say, plus, let's add on some more damages here by reopening a judgment and doing it in attack, you know, more in a cost assessment. Well, that's what's different about this case, I think.
But it's a difference without it, with it's only different procedurally.
Distinction. I think you were going to say it's a difference without a distinction.
That's
so what is, so why? I mean, I don't agree with that. So why don't you tell me why I'm wrong?
Well, it's judicial economy, Your Honor. Rather than starting another fourth lawsuit, incurring another $90-some thousand, because I know they're not going to just roll over and say, yes, your fees are reasonable. Go back to the original action where their judgment exists. Ask for the fees there. The court can, the fees were provided as part of the motion, ledger and all. He had the opportunity to say that they weren't reasonable. I don't recall his argument arguing against the reasonableness of it. Rather, he said that they were barred.
Well, the standard for getting those fees is not just whether they're reasonable. You read what the standard is for the exception for the American rule, that you had, you know, that you, through no fault of your own, you're like become intertwined with other litigation, et cetera. I mean, normally I'm wondering whether a case where someone seeks attorney's fees as part of damages against a tortfeasor, if that's a jury trial, is that a jury issue, those damages? Like, is someone entitled to a jury trial on the issues as to whether that rule applies? The exception to the rule applies?
I haven't seen a jury on the decision on the whether the American rule damages is a fact question for the jury or if it's a court decision based on the reasonableness of the fees. It's the reasonableness of the fees may be outside the purview of a jury because it's legal fees that we're talking about.
What about the other issues at stake as to whether you read the rule, you read the elements that apply to whether the rule, the exception should be invoked? I think at the start of your argument you talked about when the exception applies. Right?
Right.
And it's not just whether they're reasonable or not. It's whether a party through no fault or a tortfeasor through their wrongful conduct, like forced a party to take third party or action, et cetera. I mean, those are fact questions, I suppose, that might be, or a fact finder might have to find before the exception applies.
Those facts have already been decided, Your Honor. I mean, those facts have already been found. Any attack on those facts would be they would be collaterally stopped from asserting those facts.
They were found where? In the lawsuit against Doug Johnson?
Yes, Your Honor.
To which Jaron Johnson was not a party. That's why I think it's odd. The party you're seeking fees against as part of damages was not a party to the Doug Johnson litigation.
The focus isn't on the third-party litigation misconduct or the third-party litigation elements. It's focused, the element is focused on whether or not the misconduct or the bad acts of the bad actor causing the third party litigation.
Exactly. So did Jaron Johnson's bad actions cause that third party litigation?
Yes.
And you're saying that those facts that he caused it, his acts caused it, are found in a case involving Doug Johnson where Mr. Jaron Johnson was not present.
Well, he was a witness in the case. Now I understand
not
that
a party.
I understand he's not a party.
Yeah.
But the fact would be whether or not respondent Jaron Johnson was a pledgeor along with his corporate entity, Bennett Bartlett Law Group, that caused the fraudulent transfer. And that fact was decided in the Doug Johnson case, and it cannot, I mean, it would be collaterally stopped from arguing that it was. He was the author.
Does collateral estoppel apply to a non-party who wasn't litigating in that case, though?
I believe it would be, Your Honor. The fact can't be changed. I mean, he testified that he drafted the in the Doug Johnson case. He testified that he drafted the pledge agreement. It names him as the pledgeor. He didn't dispute that as a witness. I think all the elements of collateral estoppel would apply, and that fact would have to be stipulated to.
Well, how did a witness in the case that Judge Smith is talking about? I mean, I think one of the issues, did this person against whom collateral estoppel is being asserted have a fair opportunity to litigate the issue? How does a witness who's not a party in the lawsuit Judge Smith is talking about had a fair opportunity to litigate the issue to which you say he is now bound and can't argue, that he's now bound by it? That escapes me.
I don't know how he would.
I understand the unique facts of this case and what he is alleged to have done, but you know, at the end of the day, stuff happens all the time. But the issue is, did he have a fair opportunity to litigate that in the Judge Smith Johnson lawsuit that she's talking about?
Well, I suppose he was the initial lawyer on the case. He could have interpleaded at any time,
The problem I'm having, and I share Judge Smith's thoughtful concerns, is, I mean, you could extend this to, like, an attorney malpractice case where now, you know, the attorney who represented somebody who sued, you know, whatever, now, you know, and it was just the attorney now in a separate lawsuit, you want to amend the judgment in that case to argue, well, you know, the tortfeasor was the attorney who brought this baseless claim, so I'm going to get my attorney's fees in, I mean... I just think this could have terrifying ramifications if we went along with the argument you're making, counsel. So why am I wrong?
Well, it can have terrifying consequences if you don't. It sets a roadmap for every creditor in the state to identify how they can push assets beyond the reach of a creditor.
And those issues are litigated in a case-by-case basis, against whoever you want to sue. But I mean, amending judgments in different lawsuits I just think this is very kind of tricky, and I'm not so sure. And then if we said this, what's going to happen? I mean, people are going to be rolling here amending judgments from 5 years ago to say the tortfeasor argument, and now I get my attorney's fees under the exception to the American rule. I mean, as much as we like to have full employment here at the Court of Appeals, I'm not in favor of that full employment.
I understand your concern, Your Honor, but in the growth case, there was a stipulation that the conduct was committed, and that's how they dealt with that fact issue, Your Honor. I don't see how that can be different in this case. He's testified to it. If he's going to change his testimony now, I mean, I'd be surprised that he's going to do that, but it seems to me that the American rule applies and that the attorney's fees can be awarded. If you decide not, I guess we have to look at starting another fourth lawsuit, which again would be, I think, a waste of judicial efficiency and economy. The other reason why the lower court's decision is inaccurate, Your Honor, is because he does have the inherent authority to grant the fees. And that is an inherent authority that is beyond the statute. It's the court's ability to do that, and given the circumstances in this case, I believe that the inherent authority could have been used and should have been used.
The district court is in case number, I think of them as case number 1, 2, and 3. 1 and 2 were against Darren, 3 was against Doug. So we're up here on appeal on an order in case number 2, because you went back to case number 2 and said, please reopen the judgment and add additional attorney's fees. There already were attorney's fees awarded in that case against Jaron, pursuant to the district court's inherent authority, I think, right?
Right.
For bad faith and vexatious conduct in litigation. Now you're saying to the district court, or you said to the district court, please reopen that judgment, add fees from case 3 using your inherent authority for litigation expenses in case 3, which were denied against Doug, but you're saying please add them to Jaren's. That's confusing to me. Like, that's not just a motion for fees. Like, can someone go, again, it gets to the idea, is like when there is some finality to why is a district court compelled, you're saying, to reopen the judgment and add fees for what? There's not vexatious litigation conduct by your client in case three. He wasn't a party to it. Where's the authority for that?
It's a continuation of the vexatious conduct from two to three, Your Honor, because the fraudulent transfer occurred, was concealed, and due to the concealment, we had to start number three. The issue here is that the fees and expenses in case number three would have never happened had the fraudulent transfer not taken place.
The fraudulent transfer, that's the subject of case number two as well?
It was a fraudulent transfer where we saw evidence of Jaren Johnson transferring assets from Benapartum to himself. Mm-hmm. That case never got tried. It was a default judgment that was awarded against Jaren Johnson in favor of the appellant.
Okay.
And then they basically matched the amount of damages awarded with attorney's fees as sanctions or inherent authority award.
And does inherent authority to award attorney's fees relate to sort of the merits of a party's wrongdoing? You're saying it was a fraudulent transfer as opposed to a party's conduct with respect to litigation?
It's more with the party's conduct within the litigation that's before the court.
Okay. Thank you. Well, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Jaren Johnson, respondent in this matter. excuse me. The facts and law and the underlying motion by appellant were fully briefed and argued before Judge Jerome Abrams of the Dakota County District Court. There were three briefs and multiple supporting documents that were filed and considered by the court. Judge Abrams heard oral argument on all claims from both parties. Judge Abrams is well-versed in this case. He's retained jurisdiction over it, and as the court may know or may not know, Dakota County has a rotating judicial bench, and so it was a little unusual to have one judge kind of take the case and keep it. So he's well-versed in the facts and the issues. The issue before the court today involves a second...
I'm sorry. I thought Judge Lehman had this case. Case number two.
There's been about four judges on it, Your Honor. Currently, Judge Abrams has kept it. So it's not rotating anymore.
You mean going forward?
Going forward, there were multiple orders issued by different judges.
Right. No, I know how they operate. I was just confused by that because he didn't have it originally. He just had it for this motion.
And he's had it for discovery issues prior to this motion.
Oh, in case number two.
Yes.
Okay.
So as the issue before this court today is, as the court knows, is the second of the three cases brought by appellant. As the court knows in the briefs, the appellant was paid over $109,000 on November 22nd of 2021 from the judgment in the third case. This payment of $109,000 satisfied the judgment in the second case. Appellant issued a partial satisfaction of judgment on December 1, 2021 in the second case for the monetary judgment. Appellant reserved this present claim to add attorney's fees although the monetary judgment itself was paid. There's no authority I'm aware of that allows a judgment creditor in a case that's over to reserve claims after the judgment's paid. The case should have been over. Appellant styled his underlying motion that's before the court as a non-dispositive motion. There's a 21-day notice of motion and briefing schedule. It was very quick to decide a case where they're asking somewhere in excess of $90,000. Appellant brought his underlying motion as a request for increased costs under Minnesota Statute 549.09, Subdivision 4. From appellant's, and it's clear from appellant's original memorandum in the second case asking for these fees, dated November 2nd of 2021, at page 2 of the introduction, it states, quote, Fafinski now seeks to add the attorney's fees he incurred in the third action as additional cost of collection in the second action, of the judgment in the second action. At page 5 of his memorandum, appellant stated he was seeking increased costs and additional costs. At his conclusion in page 7 of his memorandum, appellant stated he was seeking additional costs of collection. And throughout his brief, it recites that he's seeking additional costs and increased costs under 549.09 subdivision 4. Filing his proposed order, in both the heading and at paragraph one, appellant was seeking to add attorney's fees, quote, as additional fees and costs of collection.
And what's wrong with that?
Because
in fact, case three shows that there were fraudulent that deprived him of his ability to collect.
Sure. So under 549.09 subdivision four, it's very specific. It's for increased costs of collecting that judgment. And so the argument before the court today by respondent is that he wasn't seeking to collect the judgment from respondent in the second case. He was bringing an entirely separate action against somebody else. So if you look to like, I think I cited it in the brief. If you look to the district court's template of an affidavit of increased costs, it shows things such as execution fees, service fees, sheriff's fees, orders for disclosure, orders to show cause. It's items that are actually and necessarily been paid or incurred in the enforcement of the judgment.
This is where it gets a little confusing to me because I think Doug Johnson paid the money, right?
So,
and did, are you arguing it satisfied both case two and case three?
It did.
So if the same payment satisfies both judgments, why isn't that a cost of collection on two? Why isn't Doug Johnson's payment in satisfaction of case three, which you say also satisfies case two, creditor collection cost?
So it's a double recovery issue, Your Honor. So the judgment in the third case was solely the amount of the judgment in the second case. So to allow appellant to have collected both $109,000 from Doug Johnson and then also 80-some thousand from respondent would have been double recovery for the same damages.
So isn't that trying to collect the same damages then? If they're the same damages and you're trying to collect them, why isn't that trying to collect
judgment? Appellant wasn't trying to collect them from respondent in the second case. He was suing on an entirely separate case. The 549.09 subdivision 4 envisions...
But Doug Johnson's payment nevertheless satisfied the judgment against you?
Yes.
Even though you're saying they were seeking different things? The plaintiff was seeking different things. It's a little, it's confusing to me.
Yeah,
it seems like you have your cake and eat it too.
I think the important part here, and I want to stress...
I share Judge Smith's concerns. I mean, isn't that a separate... whether we agree with what you're saying is different from, well, no matter what, if he's trying to get these attorney's fees, he's got to sue you in a separate action. I mean, that's another alternative to what you're saying. Would that be a fair statement?
That, from my reading of the case, Your Honor, that is the standard and how it's...
I realize you don't agree with that, but I think Judge Smith is right. That seems to make more sense to me as opposed to the double, you know, trying to get a double recovery. Would there then be a fifth lawsuit?
Fourth.
Gosh, I was hoping it would be a fifth one. Oh, no, hopefully I'll be gone.
getting to the two, and so appellant sought to support his claim for additional costs and fees on the collection of the second judgment by sliding in the third-party exception to the American rule and the court's inherent authority. And so I've heard the court's questions to appellant's counsel. The law is pretty well settled. Third-party exception applies where tort fees are thrust and other into litigation. The problem with this one is that it gives rise to a claim. It's not an automatic go back into court and reopen the judgment and just tack on your fees. This was a non-dispositive motion. It was brief, but it was brief lightly. There was no testimony from witnesses, nothing of that. There was no ability to cross-examine anybody. And so it was improper form and improper procedure to bring this, which is why I think the case law sets forth that it gives rise to a claim, but it's not an automatic additional cost. Factual matters exist that would also preclude such an automatic application. And the dates, I think, were set forth in the briefs. This pledged issue was dated January 1 of 2012. Appellant levied on the accounts receivable of Benepartum in September 1 of 2015. Appellant argued the pledge was invalid. Appellant collected money on the accounts receivable of Benepartum Law Group. The district court issued an order in the second case in October 22nd of 2015. Appellant then brought the third case on October 1, 2018 for transfer of the accounts receivable. Keep in mind, it's important to stress, at this point, appellant had owned them for 3 years and had collected on them, but yet he brought the third case to try and recover the accounts receivable. So he could not have been thrust into litigation by the alleged tortious acts because he already had the accounts receivable for which he was claiming he was entitled to. As the court mentioned, the attorney's fees were denied in that third action. And then finally, one additional claim on third-party exception. It doesn't apply. One of the cases I found, it does not apply with joint tortfeasors. Appellant has argued that both respondent and Doug Johnson were in cahoots on this. And so under the 1 Point Solutions LLC v. Borchert case, Eighth Circuit case from 2007, that third-party exception wouldn't apply to joint tortfeasors. So all of these are issues, I think, Your Honors, that make it much better to have it litigated in a separate case. There's all kinds of issues at play, whether they're warranted or not. finally, the inherent authority, I think, is a pretty clear-cut issue. The inherent authority of a district court to award sanctions is based on the authority of a court to administer the cases before it. It applies to procedural actions taken by a party in the litigation before that court. A finding that the party is engaged in bad faith must be specifically set forth. And this is important, Your Honors, it doesn't apply to the underlying actions taken by a party, and that's in the Anderson v. Medtronic case, a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1986. And so the transfer of the accounts receivable, that transfer does not warrant an inherent authority sanction. It's the conduct before the court. And there was no conduct before the third case by respondent, and there's no conduct in the second case for which they can try and attach, no present conduct, for which they can attach those attorney's fees from the third case. So the transfer of the accounts receivable by itself wouldn't warrant sanctions, inherent authority sanctions. And as the court has noted, respondent was not a party to the third action and could not defend or participate in defense of the claims asserted by appellant. So in closing, Your Honors, the district court inquired of appellant as to what statutory authority existed to award attorney's fees, clearly focusing on Minnesota Statute 549.09 Subdivision 4, as the motion had been styled by the appellant. Appellant turned again to the third-party exception and could cite no other authority, and the district court denied appellant's motion. So I think it's a narrow issue. Appellant has said that the district court stated there's no legal authority. That's not what it said. It said there's no legal authority to support what you're asking for under the styling of your motion. The district court has authority. I mean, to say that the court abused its authority by not awarding sanctions seems to cut against the fact that the court has authority and discretion to rule on its own cases. The district court did not commit reversible error in its order dated November 23rd, 2021. And this court should affirm that decision of the district court. If there's any questions, I'm happy to take them.
I have a few questions.
Yes.
And maybe I'll start with you, and then perhaps opposing counsel can address them. I share the concerns that have been mentioned. And I'd like to step back from, you know, the American rule, the attorney fee issue, just to the procedural issue of how does one go into an existing judgment and ask that it be increased in a later lawsuit? And so I'm looking at the rules of civil procedure. I see nothing that says, here's the rule that says how you go back and amend a judgment. There's, you know, Rule 60, relief from judgment or order. That's not really what we have going on here. So I'm not seeing a procedural rule that allows a party to say, I want to go back to this judgment that's 3 or 4 years old and increase the amount of the judgment based on something that's happened in another suit. And then we're told that the motion is primarily based on 549.09 sub 4, which is a way for a judgment creditor to file an affidavit, specify the nature and amount of taxable disbursements paid or incurred to collect. So what does taxable disbursements mean?
So that's
So the argument, well, that means attorney's fees?
No, it specifically envisions sheriff's fees.
Right.
Serving a garnishment notice.
And the other thing that's interesting about that statute is I read it here, it's like the court administrator does this. You file an affidavit and the court administrator says, yep, you're entitled to this expense under statute or rule.
Right. We're talking hundreds of dollars here, not tens of thousands.
Right. So, and I guess maybe then on rebuttal, I'll hear the explanation of why this procedure, or where the support for this procedure is that was attempted here.
And
not even getting to the issue of American rule attorney fees, district court's inherent authority, but what was this a proper procedural process in the first place?
Yeah, I think the 549.09 subdivision 4 statute is very clear. It's just for those
costs.
Costs, those, and I wouldn't call them nominal because hundreds of dollars are still hundreds of dollars, but it's that type of thing. You know, a sheriff's levy fee, garnishment things, orders for disclosure.
Things that are clearly defined that the court administrator can look at and say, yep, you're entitled to this, you're entitled to this, you're entitled to this.
Check the box, yep.
But attorney's fees that are arguably a damage remedy seems far afield from that statute.
Well, and I think it's also important to note that the judgment was satisfied. The case is over. I mean, so now you're trying to reopen a closed case. And so that would be further procedural defect, I think.
It was satisfied the day before the hearing?
Oh, I don't have my dates
in front
of me.
Was it satisfied at the time the motion was brought?
Yes.
It was already paid at the time the motion was filed?
I believe so, and Mr. Rose can correct me if I'm not stating that date correctly, but I believe it was.
Okay.
And it certainly is by now.
And so the way that this works, and there is a judgment, one can get it, you can add to the judgment under 549.09 for the costs that are available under 549.09.
Correct.
And your argument is these are not, or this argument is, these are not the costs that are envisioned in 549.09 to be added to an existing judgment.
They weren't costs to collect the second judgment.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Good. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And rebuttal.
These were fees incurred in connection with the cost of enforcing the judgment in the second action. We satisfied the second action when the judgment was paid in the third action. And to answer your question, Your Honor, I think the transcript is quite clear that the payment of the $90-some thousand, $109,000 came in the day before the hearing of the motion, so
okay,
it was not satisfied at the time that I brought the motion, Your Honor.
So apropos of Judge Larkin's question, is there any authority that 549.09 sub 4 would include a party's attorney's fees in filing a new action as part of collection? Are there attorney's fees cases, like when one, you know, has to sue some other third party, et cetera? Is there any cases like that?
I don't have any case law on attorney's fees, Your Honor, but I don't think that the rule itself limits it to just the cost. I believe it identifies a category of costs. I don't have the rule in front of me, Your Honor. But
what about the fact that the statute 549.09, interest on verdicts, awards, and judgments, I mean, it's a lengthy statute, but as I read through, it's talking about the court administrator making these determinations and making these awards. So that those seem to be things, or perhaps the legislature envisioned things where it's clear under statute or rule that certain costs are recoverable, so the court administrator can simply make these determinations. If you're talking about attorney's fees, then you're involving a judge and factual findings and a whole litigation process, which seems beyond what 549.09 envisions.
My understanding of the rule, Your Honor, is that the court administrator can look at the motion, and then if it feels that it needs a judicial intervention or judicial guidance, they can refer it to the judge. So in the cases in which the attorney's fees are an additional cost of enforcement of a judgment, which we have here, the court administrator can then say, Judge, I need some help on this, and then we have a hearing on it. And in that case, if the judge has some issues or concerns with respect to what...
I'm looking at Subdivision 3, which references Subdivision 4, and it talks about all disbursements that are made taxable by statute or by rule of court. So what's the statute or rule of court that says these expenses are taxable automatically?
I'm not saying they're taxable automatically, Your Honor. It's within the discretion of the court to award
the fees. Well, that's why I'm wondering if...
I'm not saying that the district...
549.09 kind of provides a basis for you to get into court with this motion in the first place as opposed to doing it in a separate lawsuit.
I think it needs judicial guidance and decision on whether or not the fees are going to be allowed. And that's what...
Wait, but you see what I'm talking about? I'm not talking about whether the fees are allowed. It's like, what is your procedural mechanism? What's the authority for you to ask and a district court to grant a request to go to an existing judgment that's been satisfied and increase the amount of the judgment?
I believe it's the 549.09 statute,
right.
Your Honor.
And just to at the time of the hearing, because I thought that was an issue, was judgment two satisfied at the time of the hearing?
No, because the check had just come in the day before the hearing, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not only did I not know if it was good funds, mm-hmm. the statute says you have 10 days to satisfy it, and he was arguing about a double recovery at the time, and so I'd like to just touch on that a little bit. It's not a double recovery. The $109,000 was for the claim against respondent for what he had done with respect to the transfer of the assets. What we're asking for now is the fees to go get that money.
No, I get that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you do agree that that part of case two was satisfied then, the judgment in case two?
Yes, I issued a partial satisfaction,
okay.
Identifying that the $109,000 was received and that it's been, satisfied in that amount. And if my motion is correct, and we're awarded the attorney's fees, that'll be added, and then I guess the chase is on for those. So, nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you both. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time frame. We'll go fire up Zoom. Thank you.